From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting its inaugural season through June.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll chat with Michael Feinstein about his Sinatra project.
I'll find out what's going on at Eagle Creek Park this summer, including a free fishing day.
And I'll chat with artist Stephanie Lewis Robertson about her art installation, The Infinite Moment of Now. And of course, there's our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Michael Feinstein has an affinity for his great velvet-voiced predecessors, and Sharon Gamble had a chance to speak with him recently about the Sinatra Project, a concert taped at the Palladium, where he's the artistic director.
Do you remember the first time you encountered Frank Sinatra on television, on vinyl, anywhere in the world?
The first time I encountered Frank Sinatra?
Yeah.
It must have been with something I heard on the radio. I know that my parents had a great affection for Frank Sinatra, as did practically everyone of their generation. I remember seeing him on television in movies, but it was the voice that I heard first. It was the voice, and I was intrigued by the voice, but I didn't come to appreciate his particular magic until I was a little bit older.
And what made you realize the craftsmanship behind what he made look so easy?
It was his connection to the lyric that I learned that was the essence of what he was about, and that's something that may seem odd to people because the first thing most people think about is the voice. Yet he learned that it was what was behind the sound. It was about the intelligence and the story, telling the story. And so it's sort of a dichotomy that people talk about the greatest voice, but it wasn't only the voice that made him great.
It strikes me that one of the things that connects the two of you is, and you don't hear this term very often in music, but salesmanship. You both can really sell a song. And I don't know how you learn that. How do you learn that?
I think it comes from experience. When Al Jolson, who was certainly the equivalent of Frank Sinatra in his day being the teens and 20s, when he was at his peak, he was called the salesman of song. Mm. And everybody always wanted to get Jolson to sing their songs because they knew that he would sell them. He would make them absolutely their finest that they could be. I think it really does come from life experience and understanding that something that is on a piece of paper in notes and words has to be taken up by the individual, translated, interpreted, and then purveyed to people. It's a very odd process, and one of the odd things about it to me is that it's a very personal thing, and yet it has to be shared with a lot of people at the same time.
No pressure or anything.
Well, it really is a sort of disconnect that is necessary, in that it has to be very intimate, but there is the awareness that it is being shared with a lot of people. So it's fascinating.
Does that process change from night to night on a concert tour, depending on the audience?
Everything changes from moment to moment. Everything in life changes from moment to moment, because we are all in a moment that is never going to be the same again. And the live aspect of music is the most exciting to me, because it is an interaction with other people. And one of the things that I lament for younger generations is that a lot of people now hear music and experience it through artificial means, as opposed to the live component, which is different in every fundamental way.
One of the great things to do is to take recordings made, especially concert recordings, because then you have an approximation of that live experience, by a given artist over a number of years. So you go back to some of the early Sinatra albums and you hear his cover of From This Moment On, for example, and then you hear it later. And it's just astonishing. It sounds like a whole new song.
Yes. I think that one of the things that's interesting is that the Sinatra family has released a lot of live recordings of Sinatra, a lot of later Vegas things. I don't think they always show him to his best advantage, the later recordings, because it seems that they have the preponderance of live material that comes from the latter part of his life. And I don't know that he would always want those recordings released.
Hmm. How did you decide for both the television special and for your CD? There's such a wealth of songs identified with Frank Sinatra out there. Take us behind the scenes of the process of the ideal song set list and then whittling it down to what would fit in a certain amount of time.
Over the last several years, I've been doing a show called The Sinatra Project, which was based on a previous CD, which has been a tremendous experience of focusing on his art and work and choosing songs that would not be so on the nose that it would seem like I was imitating him. And I went through a whole process that allowed me to capture the essence of him without trying to be him. This new project, which is the Sinatra Legacy, really is about his influence on others and those who influenced him. So it is less Sinatra-centric in the sense that there are relatively few songs that are really directly connected with him, and it's really about connecting the dots. So putting the show together was broader in that sense, and therefore much more difficult, because I wanted to convey the influence he had out in the world and try and give a sense of the number of artists who shared that same sort of approach to the music. So For the television project, with the exception of a few real chestnuts towards the end of the performance, many of them are not considered to be connected with Sinatra, but they are in the sense that he sang a lot of Cole Porter, he sang a lot of Gershwin, he sang a lot of different pieces of material, if you will, that represented every aspect of his being. And so because of that, it was more challenging in one sense, and in the other, more exciting, because I hope that it will leave people with the experience of the essence of what it was that he gave us.
You kind of traced the musical DNA that led up to the creation of the Sinatra sound and then where it went from there.
In a certain way, yes, and also working with a 32-piece orchestra is in itself a tremendous representation of what he was about and is almost a lost art.
Who do you think is performing today, besides yourself, of course, who most is going to carry forward that essence?
Do you mean the essence of Sinatra?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The influence of Sinatra is so far-reaching that anybody who has ever opened their mouth, whether they even have heard of Sinatra or not, has been influenced by him by virtue of the lineage that exists and also the energy of what music and performance is about. Specific performers, I hear and see people all the time, sometimes not famous, but everywhere I go, every time I hear a classic song sung or performed, I know that they are in some way influenced by Frank Sinatra.
Hmm.
As far as mainstream performers, I suppose you could say that Michael Bublé is the one who is most palpably continuing the tradition of what we call the Sinatra tradition. It is different, though, because he does a lot more sort of pop-oriented material. And Sinatra was always first and foremost about the songwriters and the arrangers. And I am hard-pressed to find a mainstream entertainer singing standards who has that specific focus.
It seems to me that your projects might help nudge somebody in that direction.
It's interesting because years ago, a very famous entertainer of whom I'm not particularly fond used to make fun of me for talking about the songwriters and giving the background of what the stuff is about. And a lot of entertainers just don't care who wrote the songs, and I understand that. And the public, I don't think, really particularly cares. Certainly there is an affection for Gershwin, and particularly in Indiana for Cole Porter. But generally speaking, a lot of people don't seem to care anymore. And that's not terrible. It's important to me, and my mission, if you will, is to keep the work alive and to better educate and make people aware about the legacy, because it's like Shakespeare. It's just too important to lose. And so in that sense, I just hope that it keeps going, and I hope that the songs themselves are always heard and appreciated.
We live in a pretty fast-paced time, and people want to just cut to the chase, I fear.
Absolutely.
But it's the difference between sitting down at someone's home to enjoy meals that they've prepared and going through the drive-thru at a fast food restaurant. You know, there's a quality of savoring that can happen when you slow down, sit in a concert hall or sit in your club and hear and really grasp the totality of the experience, where the song came from.
Intention in life is everything. And I think that the intention behind any performance has a tremendous effect on the result, even though the performance itself may sound the same.
Sharon Gamble with Michael Feinstein. Look for the PBS special, The Sinatra Project, on our sister station, WFYI TV 20, later this year.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Creek Park Foundation and Indy Parks will kick off summer by hosting the 10th annual Kids Fishing Derby on Saturday, June 4th from 8 a.m. to noon as part of Indiana's Free Fishing Weekend. Our own fisherman, Travis DiNicola, spoke with Michelle Cloud, president of the Eagle Creek Park Foundation, and with Michael Davis, event chairman for the Fishing Derby.
Michelle, Michael, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you in our studio.
Thank you very much.
Thank
We're
you.
Happy to be here.
Glad to have you here. I am an angler myself. I love fishing, so I'm always glad to hear about events that are encouraging kids to go out and fish. This is the 10th year you've done this at Eagle Creek Park, is that correct?
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. Great. How did all this get started? This is something that's always been put on by the Park Foundation? Or
it started out as a national organization that got the ball rolling, and then mm-hmm. we got involved, heard about them, and got involved. They no longer do the event, but the last 3 years we've done it on our own. We've decided to just go ahead and continue the event.
So it's obviously something that's been successful for you. I mean, I've heard 400 some plus kids show up every year? Or
yes, we have upwards of 400. Of course, weather has something to do with that. But
sure.
Sure.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Tell me a bit about what the day is like. I know that you do encourage kids to bring their own fishing gear, their own rods and reels, baits provided, but for some kids, if they don't have equipment, you are able to provide some?
Yes, we are. We have 200 loaner rods and reels, mm-hmm. so we have that. We have bait. We have instruction. It's for children 4 to 14,
okay.
but they do need to have an adult with them. It's Saturday, June 4th, from 8 a.m. until noon, and we provide food, like I say, instruction, and just about everything you need. It's just, you know, something to promote fishing and, you know, a good family event to get people out into nature as well.
Now, do the kids need to register ahead of time at all, or can they just show up the morning of?
Well, if you register ahead of time, you can go to eaglecreekpark.org and get the registration form. Then you can, pre-registered participants can get into the park for free. But if you just show up, you're going to end up paying $5 per carload to get in.
So that's how it works.
You save a little money if you sign up early.
Well, that's an excellent benefit. And then they can register early, get in the park for free, go fishing, and spend the rest of the day at the park, right?
There you go.
Okay. Well, that's great incentive to do that. Once they get to the park, where should they go? Because it's a big park.
That's right. It's at the north end of the park, off the 71st Street entrance, and it's takes place at the Cofferdam, which is up at the north end of the park. It's a lovely spot. It's a nice. It encloses a little waterfowl nature sanctuary, and that's one of the benefits of fishing there. You can see all these wonderful birds and have a nice, easy spot to toss your line in.
And you're guaranteed to catch something, right?
Well, I don't know about that.
A good time.
Guaranteed a good time. That's fair enough. So what sort of fish are out there that the kids might be catching?
Well, they're crappies, bluegills,
catfish,
yeah, definitely catfish, and some other species that I'm not aware of. And it's catch and release, so you don't get to take them home and put them in your tank.
Right. Now,
or your frying pan.
Do you guys keep track each year as far as, you know, if a kid catches the most fish or the biggest fish or any, are there any records like that? No,
not particularly. No.
The idea is to just get out there and give it a shot. So,
now I know you mentioned instruction is available because certainly some kids, you know, this may be the first time they've ever fished and stuff. And we're just talking, you know, sort of basic fishing. You know, we're not talking fly fishing or anything like that.
No. Exactly. No. Yeah, we have a lot of volunteers that we, you know, couldn't put the event on without them.
Sure.
And so they're going throughout there and they're helping, you know, with putting the worms on the hooks. Helping with, you know, a lot of tangled lines and certainly, you know, teaching children, you know, how to cast and things like that. So it's a lot of fun because one of the things that it's meant the most to me is seeing so many children catch their first fish ever.
Sure.
And just, how happy they are and how much fun they have doing that.
Bet there's a lot of parents with their cameras out there that day
as well.
Yeah, you mentioned the tangle lines. I'm just thinking of, you know, of fishing with my nieces and nephews and stuff. I mean, that alone has got to keep your volunteers busy, I'm sure. I mean, if you've got that many kids out there, it's...
Yes,
potential for a lot of tangle lines, which is good that the lake is so big.
Yes. Right.
and now you guys provide the bait, you provide the worms, which is great. So it sounds like just a great day. I know you've got some sponsors you probably want to thank that are a part of this as well.
Yes. Walmart is one of our biggest sponsors, and they always contribute. But we've got a few others to the foundation.
Right. Barnes and Thornburg, we've got our silver sponsors, bronze sponsors. Those are folks who give an annual gift and to support lots of the programs that the foundation puts on in the park. So we're really fortunate to have those folks supporting the things we do.
Great. Now, is this a free fishing weekend all across Indiana?
Yes.
Is that right?
I was going to miss. Yes, it's, and that's why we have it. The event is always on the first Saturday in June, and it's in conjunction with the DNR's free fishing weekend.
So you don't need a license that weekend.
Correct. Any place in Indiana, and if you go to the DNR's website, there are other events that weekend that are put on specifically similar to what we have, the Kids Fishing Derby, but in other locations.
Okay.
And because of that, if we are rained out on the 4th, our rain date is Sunday the 5th, the day after. So
at least you got that chance as well. And so, I mean, you could, you know, for parents who want to take their kids fishing, they can get them registered, go out there in the morning for the Derby, and then stay in the afternoon and continue to fish if they wanted to.
Yeah.
Right?
Sure.
And stuff.
Yeah.
That's great. That's a great weekend that the DNR provides, letting people sort of sample without having to get their license. Now, this is something that's been put on, as we said, for 10 years through the Eagle Creek Park Foundation. Michelle, you're the president of that. Michael, you're on the board of that. Tell me a bit more about the Eagle Creek Park Foundation, how it supports Eagle Creek.
Well, Eagle Creek Park Foundation was formed to benefit, to enhance, preserve, promote, protect Eagle Creek Park. Eagle Creek Park is the only municipal park, the only city park in Indianapolis that requires an entrance fee, and that's because it's mandated to be self-supporting. So most of its financial support does not come from taxpayers, but comes from people who pay to get in and who buy annual passes, which you can do through the foundation. If you become a member of the foundation, you help to support the projects that we've been able to accomplish in the park, mm-hmm. like the new Earth Discovery Center and the recently opened Ornithology Center, which is a unique facility for the study and appreciation of birds. You can go down there and sit and look out the window and see tons of beautiful birds right there, like in our backyard bird feeder exhibit. You can overlook the lake and see the water birds. And there's an exhibit area inside that shows you the four basic habitats in the park mm-hmm. and the kinds of birds that you'll see there. And it kind of challenges you to actually find those birds because they're as if they were in nature. So it's just really a great facility. Then the Eagle Creek Park Foundation has spent over probably $2.3 million over the years to fund projects large and small. For mm-hmm. instance, we funded the construction of the new concert stage at the marina, which is home to our jazz series.
Yeah, that'll be great. That'll get a lot of use this summer, right?
Absolutely. And that our free concerts start on June 1st with Concert in Nature. And on June the 8th, we start with our jazz series with Jared Thompson, Premium Band, and the series ends with...
And if you hadn't heard Jared Thompson before, he is an amazing, amazing jazz musician. Just a lot of fun. I really enjoy his music a lot.
Well, there's a fabulous lineup of, mm-hmm. of jazz musicians. The final participant is Kathy Morris, who will mm-hmm. be out there on August 31st.
Who's always a great crowd pleaser.
Yes, mm-hmm. and she's a favorite of mine. I used to live over in the... near the Broad Ripple area, mm-hmm. and she played a lot at the Jazz Kitchen, and I was lucky enough to get over there and watch her. And there are also lots of things going on for families at the Earth Discovery Center. There are all kinds of programming, day camps for kids. You can drop in there and see all the great exhibits and learn some things. You can drop in at the Ornithology Center and see their birds. We have some raptors there. There's Sunday morning bird hikes, so you can go out and with lots of really very exceptional birders. And if you've never done it before, you don't have to know hardly what a bird is because they'll teach you all about it. Kevin Carlson, who is the senior naturalist and really sort of the driving force for the Ornithology Center out there, is a fabulous birder. And I always like to go out with him because he shows me things I never even heard of. So those are opportunities.
Well, and one thing that makes Eagle Creek Park a little bit different than the other city parks as well is that you guys have your own website,
right?
Which is great because it makes it really easy if you go to eaglecreekpark.org to find all the information about the different nature and educational activities as well as the concerts and other events.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I find it very easy to use. It's a great website you guys have.
Good. Well, thank you.
Yeah, it's the go-to site.
Good. So, Michael, are you a fisherman yourself? Are you getting excited about this fishing weekend?
You know, I fish a little bit.
Uh-huh.
Luckily, I've got a very nice neighbor moved in a couple years ago that has his own boat and actually is a fishing guide part-time. So mm-hmm. I get to experience it a lot more. But the attraction to the event for me is I've done a lot of working with small children. Mm-hmm. My children are big and older, although I have a grandchild now. But, working with the kids is probably
sure.
the main attraction to me and introducing them to nature because I love hiking and doing things outdoors. And so the more we can get kids away from TV and the internet and get them outdoors, I think the better.
Absolutely. And introduce them to the park as well.
Right.
Yes.
Good. Good. Well, thank you both so much for coming in to Art of the Matter today, and a pleasure to chat with you both, and looking forward to the fishing weekend and also everything else going on at Eagle Creek Park this summer.
Yeah, come on out to the concerts.
Thank you much.
Travis DiNicola with Michelle Cloud, president of the Eagle Creek Park Foundation, and Michael Davis, event chairman for the Fishing Derby. The free Fishing Derby for kids takes place on June 4th from 8 a.m. to noon at Eagle Creek. Bait is provided for the kids' fishing derby, but participants are asked to bring their own fishing equipment. A limited number of rods and reels will be available for children without gear, and remember, it is all catch and release. More information is at eaglecreekpark.org. Again, eaglecreekpark.org.
Well, Sharon, the weekend is finally here.
I know. I've been waiting for this one.
This is a big weekend. There is a lot going on this weekend. Coppelia, Broad Ripple Art Fair, Walking for Dreams, lots of great other theater and shows. All things that we're going to talk about on that calendar we call
What Do We Do?
Yeah, Broad Ripple Art Fair. So it's officially like sort of, you know, end of sort of spring,
end of spring
into summer almost.
That's right.
You're getting ready for that. And of course, that's all day Saturday and Sunday up at the Indianapolis Arts Center. Always just a great time to go up there and check things out at the Broad Ripple Art Fair.
And if you spend Saturday there and you're still not done, you can get back in.
That's right. That's right. You can get like a wristband.
A wristband. And don't forget to go in the buildings and look in the classrooms.
That's right. There's cool stuff in there, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And don't forget to go around the buildings. So it's easy to just like, you know, hang out on the baseball diamond or the parking lot. And then and forget there, if you go back and then down by the river, there's more stages there and more art down there as well.
All sorts of great things to do.
Cool.
And if you forgot to get your mom a present for Mother's Day a couple of weeks ago, you can redeem yourself.
Perfect time
Woo-hoo.
To do so. Mm-hmm. What else you got?
You know what? Here's something for the history lover in your life. It's an exhibition at the Harrison Home. It's called Windows to the Past, Harrison's Indianapolis, and the exhibit follows President Benjamin Harrison and his wife to their Delaware Street home, traces the progress of Indianapolis from a small state capital to a large metropolitan city, covering the years from about 1854 to 1913, and that's there were so many changes. Boy, if we think things change fast in the internet age, that's not the only time things have changed fast. But if, for the history lover in your life, whether you're a geek about presidential history or not, you can just go and see this great display of photographs and documents. And it's just a different window into history, pun intended. Windows to the Past, Harrison's Indianapolis, on view now at the President Benjamin Harrison Home.
Well, this is something for the art and history lover and also baseball lover.
Oh?
Yeah, there's an exhibit at NAMOS, the National Art Museum of Sport, that's just opened that runs through the baseball season this year, and it's in celebration of 125 consecutive years of professional baseball in Indianapolis. And so there's a nice tie-in here with the Indianapolis Indians, of course. Who've been in town in one form or another since 1887.
I didn't know the Indians were that old.
Yeah, yeah. Indianapolis' first professional sports team.
Wow.
Yeah, very cool. So what NAMOS is doing is they are having an exhibit of over 45 works of baseball art from their permanent collection that are on exhibit. Now, the museum is located in the Conference Center building at the hotel at University Place on the campus of IUPUI. And as part of this exhibit, 18 graphite and ink original cartoons by Willard Mullen, who was named the sports cartoonist of the 20th century. He's really considered to be sort of the Rembrandt of the sports pages. And used to do a lot of work with the New York World Telegram back in the 30s, and his most famous cartoon was the Brooklyn Dodger bum that used to like take the people to Ebbets Field, and he was a cab driver and would do in this cartoon like, how are bums doing today? Anyway, if you know this stuff, it's very fun. Mullen's cartoons are great, as well as there's a lot of other cool artwork on display, all celebrating baseball at the National Art Museum of Sport.
Take your favorite baseball fan with you to explain the context. That sounds great.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. You know that it's almost summer when you're starting to plan into your calendar the Films on the Terrace, the Ooh. IMA Summer Nights movies. This year it kicks off with a movie that didn't really intend to be funny. It is Mommy Dearest. Came out in 1981. Faye Dunaway, who really camped it up as Joan Crawford. I mean, how else could you act if you're trying to be Joan Crawford? I know, right? You have to make sure you pay attention to see the No More Wire Hangers scene. If you don't know what we're talking about, make sure you buy your tickets and go see Mommy Dearest. And what a beautiful place to see it at the IMA Amphitheater. And you can watch the sunset and just have a grand old time. That is coming up on June 3rd, Mommy Dearest at the IMA, the start of the summer film series.
Very, very, very fun. Hey, if you haven't had a chance to see G2 in concert, those are the students that perform with Gregory Hancock Dance Theater. They are performing this weekend up at the Academy of Gregory Hancock Dance Theater, located up in Carmel. Performance on on Sunday at 2 p.m. And also this weekend, I mentioned earlier, the Ballet Capella is being performed by the Indianapolis School of Ballet, and I just happen to be playing the role of the mayor in that.
I was going to ask you if you were reprising your role.
They actually asked me to come back, and so it's not really a dance role. It's more of a pantomime role, but I'll be reprising that.
Is this a dignified mayor?
It's a very dignified mayor of a very small town with a few men and a lot of beautiful ballet dancers.
Well, gee, I can see why you said yes to that assignment.
Of course, it's a great job.
And those performances are both at
3 p.m. Saturday and Sunday at the Scottish Rite Cathedral.
Very good. Love that.
A lot of good dance going on this weekend.
Now, if you have really little people listening to the radio, turn your volume down for about 45 seconds because I'm going to talk about something they might ask you questions about. Ron Spencer, last year he amused us, have you turned the volume down yet, with America's Next Top Bottom. And he's back. He had so much fun writing that. He was like, I'm going to write something else. And of course it's going to be campy. This year it's Assorted Fruits and Vegetables. And it's on stage for one more week. It is described as a spitfire comedy about an all-gay retirement community where one man's irreverent attitude and turbocharged sex drive wreaks havoc when fueled by a handsome young Latino caregiver and by a little blue pill. Assorted Fruits and Vegetables on stage at Theater on the Square. If you know what to expect from Tots, you won't be disappointed.
Not
I'll just put it that way.
And the last thing I'm going to mention on our calendar this week, this is the last weekend for Chicago, the musical, which is being performed by the Actors Theater of Indiana and is taking place, of course, at the Studio Theater up in Carmel. And that goes on this weekend with performances Saturday at 8 p.m. and Sunday at 2 p.m.
I got to see that a couple of weeks ago. Great, strong production and a nice introduction to the Studio Theater as well.
Excellent.
Yeah. And now for something completely different from America's, well, I won't say it in case you've turned your volume back up, to the Arts and Crafts Movement, Simplicity and Design. It's a three consecutive part exhibition at the T.C. Steele State Historic Site. And the second installation of it is up now. The second installation includes pottery, furniture, fine art, graphic arts, and textiles. You can go find out more about that just Google T.C. Steele State Historic Site.
Very good. We'll be back next weekend for Memorial Day and more on that calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Stephanie Lewis Robertson didn't expect her husband to have a stroke at the age of 50 a couple of summers ago. But then again, life brings us lots of unexpected experiences. And Stephanie took the fear and uncertainty of the situation and used her art to see it in a new way. Sharon Gamble spoke with her about her new art installation called The Infinite Moment of Now.
We pray to you for Tom. We ask that you be here with us and help us so that we can set the love and the gratitude, the gifts for all he has given to us and all the gifts that you have to offer. Pray to you, rest. Pray to you. Thank you so much for your balance, for your introspection, for helping us.
I'm curious. This is a hard question to ask an artist, but At what point in the series of incidents that led to the creation of this exhibition did you say to yourself, my art will help me?
I knew it all along. I found myself, after the second day that Tom was in the hospital, they put up the MRIs, the scans of his brain hemorrhage and the stroke, and they were so beautiful. And I kept going over and looking at them, and the whole time I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, okay, well, there's where the stroke is, there's where the bleed is, that's where the clot is. But, oh, look at how beautiful these shapes are and these lines are. And the whole time I kept thinking, I got to do something with this. I've got to do something with this. And I knew that I was up for a show at the Art Center. I had applied for one and been accepted, but I hadn't finalized a date or finalized the show. And so must have been maybe after he was out of the worst of it that I contacted the Art Center and said, I know what I want to do. It's going to be about this. Give me a date. And so we set up the date then, and I blew up there and I said, here's what it's going to be about. Here's the MRIs. This is it. And they said, okay. And they gave me a date. And then they changed the date on me, which is actually good because they originally said it would be in January of this year. And then they changed it to June of this year. And that's really good because I need all the time I can get for the show.
So that's almost, by the time the exhibit is open, almost 2 years.
Yes.
Since
a little
Tom's
bit shy.
Stroke.
Yeah.
Did you say any of that out loud to anyone? Look how beautiful that is.
All the time. I think that I have to say that I have a wonderful support community, and they were there. There were artists, there were musicians, there were just the friends and people from my church and people from other churches that were coming in, and I would take them to the MRIs, and I'd say, look at how beautiful these are. And a lot of people said, oh, yeah, right, uh-huh, yeah, they are.
Whatever you say, Stephanie, we'll humor you.
That's right. Well, and I, in my naivete, but I like to think that it was more in my positive attitude, I did not know how sick Tom was until we went to leave the hospital. And that was when they told me that they never thought that he would be talking again. They never thought that he would have his eyes open or that he would be able to use his hands or his legs, that they thought he would be a vegetable. And I did not know that. I mean, Tom asked me, did I ever come close to dying? And I said, I never got that sensation that you were close to dying. So we asked the doctor, we asked Dr. Speck, I think, and he stopped. I said, we want to know how close Tom came to dying. And Dr. Speck stood there, and you could see him looking into himself for how to answer this. And I wanted the honest answer at all times. And they never told me this until he left. But he said, we never thought that he would be anything less than a vegetable when he left here. So that became this rallying cry for me also, in that I had these people who surrounded him with love. We surrounded him with prayers. As my friend Mark Herder said, she was there every night with him, and we told the doctors and the nurses, we will take care of the woo-woo, and you take care of the medical stuff, and we'll do all the woo-woo. And we had a lot of woo-woo going on in there.
You had a journal that was passed on from one person to the next. Talk about that.
I had a journal in the room so that people could take notes and keep notes, and that was really wonderful because I could find out what had happened overnight, all of his stats were and what kind of meds he was on. And then I also kept a Caring Bridge journal, which was an online journal. I started out actually on Facebook, but it was so overwhelming and I didn't let anyone know for 2 days or I let some people know on Facebook, but I said, please don't publish this because my family was on vacation and I knew my niece was checking Facebook every day, and I didn't want them to find out, my parents, until I knew what was going on from Facebook. And so then after I posted it on Facebook and said, okay, it's okay, because I had told them, I had my brother tell them, then somebody, Kate Obereich and Mark Herter, told me about Caring Bridge and set up a Caring Bridge site, which is fabulous. And I don't know how many other people have used it in the way that I did. From what I understand, a lot of people didn't really delve deeply into how they were experiencing what was going on with their loved ones. But for me, it became this nightly way to communicate to everybody and to say, here's what happened. And it became a very spiritual experience. The whole experience was gentle, and there was this love presence. People would walk into that room, and you'd be in this neurological critical care unit at Methodist Hospital, and there'd be clanking noises and whirring noises and beep, 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 and all these things, and code blue, and you'd walk into his room, and it was like peacefulness descended in that space, and people felt it when they walked in that room. And even in the waiting room, there was that sensation when my people came, because we were very mindful about staying calm and not getting agitated. And I wouldn't let anyone in who was bordering on that, because Tom didn't need that. If you read Jill Bolte Taylor's book, My Stroke of Insight, which is amazing, she talks about that any bit of agitation can cause agitation, and that you don't want to cause that, that the brain needs to rest and needs to sleep and needs to do what it needs to do to heal itself.
To repair itself. You know, we all, even intelligent people, think that they know how the how hospitals work, how critical care works, because, you know, there are all sorts of mass market movies and there are television programs where something is wrapped up neatly in the, 46 minutes of taking out time for commercials. But of course, it's medicine is still in many ways very much more an art than a science. And every case is individual.
Right.
And you, I'm sure, weren't expecting, nor was Tom, expecting to have a stroke at 50, 51?
He was 50, yeah.
Let alone, you know, what is that particular journey?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that the nurses and the doctors would tell me, oh, he's a hot mess, and, oh, it's going to be a long recovery, you're in for the long haul. But they were also amazed at what happened. And I think also amazed at how much support we had from the arts community, from our church community, from our different families and communities. And by family, I'm not talking just about my blood relatives or his blood relatives, but the families that we've created here in Indianapolis. And I honestly believe that it was both the medical profession and all of us that helped save Tom and bring him through. And, you know, he's amazing. He's brilliant. And the whole time he was under, I also kept saying, I know he's there because he's responding to me in certain ways. Tom McTamney came in, and they had just gotten back from a cruise. In fact, I think you had told Tom and Larry that they were, that Tom was in the hospital, my Tom, not Tom McTamney. And they came over immediately. And Tom said, I said, do you want to go back and see him? And Tom said, well, I don't know what to say. I said, well, what kind of food did you have? And he said, oh my God, we had these incredible scallops and they were pan-seared. And Tom's right toe started wiggling. And this was while he was deeply under. So I knew he was in there. I knew it.
He was, we should say, for somebody who's had a different experience of what a stroke is, that he was put under, what is it? is it called an artificial coma, or what is the terminology for it?
I guess that would be what they would call it. I can't even remember. All I know is they said, we got to knock him out because he's such a mess right now, and there were so many things wrong. I mean, he had a sinus infection, he had sleep apnea, he had AFib, an irregular heartbeat, and he was spiking hot and then cold, and they just didn't know what to do. They had to intubate him, which meant they had to put him on a ventilator. And eventually they ended up having the ventilator. They couldn't get the tubes down his throat because his throat was so swollen that they ended up giving him a trach. And then they gave him a feeding tube because I think they thought he would never be able to eat again. And he fooled all of us because 24 hours later he had spaghetti and he wasn't supposed to be able to talk with a trach, and he talked because nobody told him. If you ask him, he said, well, nobody told me I couldn't. I mean, nobody told me how sick he was. So I just believed he was going to come back and he was going to be good. And he is good. He's different than he was, but he's good.
You know, it's an interesting, I don't know what you'd call it, a vote of confidence somehow that there's a sponsor for your exhibit.
Yes, there is.
It's, from the medical community.
It is. Dr. Painter works for Goodman Campbell, and they are a neurological group up on the north side. And Dr. Painter was one of the first neurosurgeons that Tom saw, and he was just beaming every time he saw Tom after the fact. And so when I finally got the dates nailed down, I called him and said, this is an opportunity for you. I would love for you guys to sponsor this show. This is going to get your word out about strokes and about the brain and traumatic brain injury to people that wouldn't normally get this, because this is such an important message. And they said yes. Drew Carey, really his name is Drew Carey.
Bless his heart.
I know. He is the marketing man there, and I met with him, and he said, absolutely, this sounds like we need to do this. So Goodman Campbell, thank you so much for supporting this. But there are also, I have to, before I forget to mention this, there is sound with this.
I was going to ask you how you normally work in fabric, which is, I assume, a fairly quiet medium.
Right.
How did you decide to add the element of sound design?
If you know me, people who know me out in the world know that I also sang for many years with the women's chorus, and that music is really important to me. And for a long time, I've been thinking about how do I create this interactive thing, because my work has always been very pretty, but it's been up on the wall, and there's this remove. And my work in community is to create art in community through my classes at Ivy Tech, through the Art Center, IMCPL, through my church, through other organizations. I love working in community. And I want it to have this be more interactive, because we also, the thing about the brain is we learn from so many different ways. We learn auditory, we learn visual, kinesthetic. And so I wanted that experience. And so Marg Herter, who's a sound engineer and a really good friend of mine who was there every night, as I mentioned, recorded the sounds of the hospital. We got permission from the hospital to just record in his room and a couple of other sounds. And she kept that track. And then we went ahead and I asked my friends and my communities to come in and do some prayers and to sing, some women from the chorus and other friends. And so we've recorded some of those. So we've got Buddhist prayers, we've got Christian prayers, we've got Native American prayers, we've got pagan Wiccan prayers, the rosary, and all of this is merged together because Marg is genius. And so the sound runs, this loop runs for 25 minutes, so that as you come into that space, you are going to be surrounded with this visual work, but you're also going to experience how we felt in that space. And it's absolutely stunning. The sound is, it's so loving and calm. And at the same time, you hear the beep, 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 and the whirs and all of these. But it's almost like that's a heartbeat It's the metronome that's running underneath, and then these voices merge in and out. And the imagery is like that, that the imagery merges in and out of the background. I used all of his MRIs as the base layer for each of the panels. This work looks nothing like anything that I've done before, but I think it's the most important work I've ever done.
Tom, your heart is Sharon Gamble with artist Stephanie Lewis Robertson. The sound you are hearing is by Marg Herter. You can see The Infinite Moment of Now, a fabric and sound installation by Stephanie Lewis Robertson at the Indianapolis Arts Center from June 10th through July 31st.
I pray to you, most dearly loved,
whoever you are,
when you come out of this stroke
and out of this silence and out of this shadow land that makes me crazy. Because I feel helpless and can do nothing for you
with his
except come and talk to
so
you and read to you and maybe sing a little to you.
Provide us that we participate in the healing so that Tom and his family and his community may all be as it ought to be. Thank you so much for the enlightenment, East. We call on you in the foreland, in the two languages, in the deep and cross, so that we may all be a part of the
walking away,
and that we may all be a part
of
his
journey,
that we may all be a part
of the healing process.
Great Mother,
blessed
be the Spirit that holds us all. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4, when I get a preview of the Modus Dance Company's Pairings Concert.
I'll find out more about the Great American Songbook.
And I'll chat with a couple of artists who are part of this year's Talbot Street Art Fair. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting its inaugural season through June. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.